Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Viglund. You know, sometimes the economy stuns even economists like this one.
It's shocking. It's shocking.
That's Mark Zandi with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Mark was taken aback by one recent economic phenomenon.
It's shocking. It's shocking.
So what blew Mr. Zandi's mind? Was it A, the seesawing stock market? He thought investors were too chill to get so panicky. Or was it B, the $3 billion Goldman Sachs recently threw down to shore up one of its hedge funds? The fund lost 30% of its value in a week. Or could Zandi not fathom C, $1,600 concert tickets? That's what some Londoners paid to see Barbara Streisand's UK tour this summer. Stumped? Remain calm. The answer is minutes away on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
10%, that's the magic number for the major stock indices. A 10% drop on the Dow, S&P 500, and NASDAQ equals an official market correction. Get out the red pens. I'm Tess Viglund. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
So, how's your 401k balance? I know, we're not supposed to be tracking the daily ups and downs, we're in it for the long haul, but I broke down. 4 weeks ago, I was up 14.5% on the year. This week, I'm down to a wimpy 2% gain. But at least I'm not trying to get a mortgage right now. The nation's biggest mortgage lender, Countrywide Financial, borrowed more than $11 billion this week to shore up its ability to make loans. That is the epitome of what everybody's calling a massive worldwide credit crunch, contagion, convulsion, pick your poison. Mark Zandi is the chief economist at Moody's Economy.com. And Mark, let's go really basic here. What exactly is a credit crunch?
It's when all borrowers can't get credit, those with bad credit histories and no down payment, and those with good credit histories that may in fact have a down payment.
And how does that happen?
That happens when lenders are very, very scared and nervous and their own sources of funding dry up.
Is the credit actually gone, or is it that banks and other financial institutions are simply holding on to the money that they have?
It's that they're holding on. They just don't want to extend it to anybody because they're fearful they won't get it back.
But, you know, I've read that this subprime mess is really quite contained. We're talking about, you know, foreclosures that are a fraction of the subprime market itself. The subprime market is a fraction of the overall housing market and certainly the overall economy. So why would something like this have such an effect throughout the markets?
Because no one knows who is suffering the losses. People are defaulting on their mortgages. So investors who are relying on those mortgage payments are losing money. And if you've invested with a hedge fund, let's say, who's potentially losing money, you want your money back. And so everyone's pulling their cash out because they really just don't know who's bearing the brunt of these losses in the subprime mortgage world.
What about other kinds of credit aside from mortgages? As this belt gets tighter and tighter, what about, for example, those the zero interest offers that you get at the car lot or if you go to a Circuit City or a Best Buy? Is that going to go away too?
Yeah, those are going to be very rare if you can get them at all. Lenders are now nervous about the spillover effects of all this on all borrowers, whether they be mortgage borrowers or auto loan borrowers or credit card borrowers. So lenders are now very nervous about extending credit to anyone. Now, they're still going to make a loan if you want a credit card loan or if you want an auto loan, but they're going to require that you give them more information about yourself or pay up a higher interest rate. And they're certainly not going to give you the kind of deals they were giving you just a few weeks ago.
Again, why is that, given that really has no relation to the subprime mess?
Well, part of it is that lenders are now very nervous about households in general. I mean, if people are having trouble making their mortgage payment, then it's possible they're going to have difficulty making an auto loan payment or a payment on a credit card. Moreover, they sense that in parts of the country where the housing mortgage markets are going south, the job market's weakening. They're still extending the loans and the credit. They're just being more cautious because they're fearful that they might not get their money back or they might not get it back in a timely way.
As an economist, does it surprise you at all that this has all happened in such a relatively short period of time? I mean, I've read where people were expecting to get a certain mortgage 3 weeks ago, and all of a sudden that mortgage has been pulled out from under them.
It's shocking. It's shocking. I mean, we have a very sophisticated economy and financial system, and for people to effectively panic is just very, very surprising. We've done a lot to ensure that we don't have these crises of confidence, these panics, but they're still there. You know, we're still emotional beings, and you can see that in the events of the recent few days.
Mark Zandi is chief economist for Moody'sEconomy.com. Thanks for helping us out today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
To illustrate this next story, we thought we'd lighten up a little with some help from Seinfeld, the one where George's folks want to move to Florida, to the same complex where Jerry's folks live, because they know the Seinfelds don't want them there.
Hello?
This is Frank Costanza.
What do you want?
You think you can keep us out of Florida?
We're moving in lock, stock, and barrel. We're going to be in a pool. We're going to be in a clubhouse. We're going to be all over that shuffleboard court. And I dare you to keep me out!
In the end, of course, the Costanzas changed their minds. But with all those baby boomers about to retire, we could be seeing more situations like that one. I mean, they can't all go to Florida. So here's an option. Retire in another country. Sounds divine. But Jeremy Hobson tells us it brings up all kinds of other Seinfeldian buffer zone issues.
Roseanne Knorr has written a book called The Grown-Up's Guide to Retiring Abroad. It lays out the ups and downs of countries around the world. But wherever you go, she says, simplify your finances.
You don't want to be enjoying yourself on a sunny day in a cafe and suddenly worried that your stocks are going to tank and you have to reach your broker.
So you don't want several bank accounts to check or a complicated stock portfolio. Just streamline. And to save money, be prepared to live like a local, not like a tourist.
Go native, because that's the way to meet the people. So the less money you have, the more fun you can have.
Knorr says you've also got to weigh the quality and cost of healthcare, transportation back home, and of course the exchange rate. Now, there are no reliable numbers on how many Americans are retiring abroad, but it's clear many are going to Mexico, which ranked number one on International Living Magazine's list of the best places to retire. Here's the magazine's editor, Kathleen Petticord.
Very affordable cost of living. It's very accessible for an American. You can drive there. Great weather. It's a very big, diverse country. It's beautiful.
Some go farther. In the southern hemisphere, New Zealand is king, and in mainland Europe, it's France.
Mesdames et messieurs, bonjour. Je suis Guy, votre chef de bord. Bienvenue à bord d'Eurostar à destination de Paris-Gare du Nord.
So I went in search of an American retiree living in Paris, and in no time, I wound up at the apartment door of 76-year-old Peter Haidu.
Hi, Jeremy. Hello. What happened?
It's a fourth-floor walk-up, which he apparently is used to by now. He's been living here since 2003. Haidu spent much of his career as a professor of medieval French literature at UCLA. Hundreds of books line a living room with high ceilings and big windows.
I feel a little bit guilty because I have this magnificent amount of light, northern exposure, the space, and I'm not an artist. What do you want? So I'll feel guilty.
Well, as everyone knows, the best way to deal with guilt is to eat, so we head out for lunch.
Beyond lunchtime.
The restaurant is a boisterous brasserie near the Place de la Bastille. The entrees are between 20 and 30 euros, so it's not an everyday thing for Peter Haidu. Most of the time, he goes to the local markets and cooks at home. The weakening of the dollar has been felt, he says. The value in euros of his $6,000 monthly retirement salary has dropped by about 10% since he arrived in Paris.
It makes a dent, no question about it. But it's a dent. And I can drive a car with a little dent in it.
What does that mean? Cheaper cheese? Not as good wine sometimes?
When I buy cheese, I never think of the price.
There are hiccups, as he puts it, in dealing with living abroad. That free French health system doesn't apply to him, and he's had trouble getting reimbursed by his American health insurance companies. But on the whole, Peter Haidu says it's worth it.
I could live in a much larger space, but it's important to me to be in Paris. It's important to me to have available to me the culture of Paris, and I wouldn't get all that in the countryside. I wouldn't get all that in Florida either.
Now, if you're still thinking this may be out of your league, consider this. Many people don't retire abroad for the rest of their lives. It can be more of a multi-year sabbatical. In fact, even Peter Haidu plans to return to the U.S. He says he'll move to New York in 2 years when his French lease runs out to be closer to his kids. In Paris, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Ah, yes, it may be summer, but here at Marketplace Money, summer school is in session. Market analysts pay close attention to numbers and hard facts, but they also look at something else a tad more subjective, how the average person feels about the economy. It's called consumer sentiment or confidence, and it plays a big part in predictions about the economy. At the Blackboard this week, economist Diane Swonk.
There's two measures of consumer confidence that are watched in the U.S. economy. One is called the Consumer Confidence Index by the Conference Board. The other major index is the Consumer Sentiment Survey. That's the older survey, and it was originated actually for the automakers to understand how consumers felt, what their buying attitudes were about vehicles. That's why it came out of the University of Michigan. In general, they have both two very similar components. Half of the survey is sort of, how do you feel about the future? And that part of the survey, we call it a headline effect. It's almost an IQ test, the expectations. The really more indicative side for actual spending is, how are your current finances doing? And that side of both the consumer sentiment and the consumer confidence surveys really tell you a lot more about what a consumer's really got, you know, money in their pocket to burn, whether they're going to spend. And you can see them diverge quite dramatically when we have these big world events. The confidence numbers actually do give you a sense of how people feel about their own living standards. And it's those kinds of issues, when you combine these data together, you start to get a much more rich view of the picture for Americans and why you might get some political turbulence when even your numbers look good. It's a worse indicator of overall growth in the economy, because we can see times when consumers spend and they feel lousy. In fact, in our economy, you know, sometimes when you feel lousy, you spend to feel better. And so the difference between how you feel about the world versus what your own pocketbook is. And like I said, the expectations are dramatically influenced by whatever goes on in the headlines.
Our teacher this week was Diane Swonk. She's the chief economist with Mesirow Financial in Chicago. Next week, what's the difference between a bond's yield and its price? What happens to your loan when your mortgage company declares bankruptcy? Chris goes through the fine print in the mailbag. And not everyone in Hollywood is unscrupulous.
I have never personally used the casting couch. I'm sure it's out there.
A day in the work life of a casting director. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. On Monday, Showtime debuted its series Californication. It stars David Duchovny, a.k.a. Foxy Fox Mulder of The X-Files. Casting him was probably a no-brainer. But how do you pick all those other actors to fill roles in an average TV season, especially with a trillion waiters and waitresses to choose from? On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we visit Californication's casting director as she auditions wannabe starlets for a bit part.
All right, stand over there, slate your name and your height for the camera.
Melody Spivak, 5'5".
And just, you'll direct it all to me, the line, okay? Whenever you're ready.
Spare any change?
That's funny. Good job, Melody. Thank you.
Bye. My name is Felicia Fasano. I'm a casting director, and I work in Los Angeles, California. Almost every casting director I know has fallen into casting. Casting is not something you go to school for. People come by it from being actors, being agents or managers. I personally came from the art department, which is a little different direction, but we all learned how to be casting directors from working for a casting director. I was an assistant for Jackie Birch for 3 years, and then I went on my own. It's been 16 years now. When an actor walks to the audition room to audition, I can't really tell if they're going to get the part till they start to read, but I can sometimes tell if they're not going to get the part, if their look is completely wrong for what we're looking for. And unfortunately, some actors just psych themselves out, and so when they come in here, there's really nothing I can do to help them. They've already lost the job on their own. I had that happen the other day with an actor, and he just said, "I'm sorry, this sucks." And I was like, "Well, you know, it's not that it sucks. It's just you're overthinking it. Just do it." I have never personally used the casting couch. I'm sure it's out there. I mean, you hear more stories of producers or directors using the casting couch. And what I like to say is, casting is not a dating service. Thank you. In episodic casting, a beginning casting director could make close to $100,000 a year. Myself and other casting directors who are more experienced and work on multiple shows, maybe doing more than one pilot and more than one series in a year, could make close to $200,000 a year. The most attractive thing about this job is the actors. To be in a room and watch somebody take words on a page and breathe life into it, there's nothing like that. When I was casting Barbershop, we had people coming in to read to play a part, and one of the lead actors, Anthony Anderson, came and read with them, and the room just turned into a circus because Anthony was jumping off the top of a rafter, and it was so much fun, and everyone was just having a great time, and it because I read with the actors, I get pulled into it as well, so then all of a sudden I'm an actor, you know, and it's, so that's fun. I don't have a very big ego. It's not a power trip for me. I want everyone to do well. I don't want to have to see 3,000 people for a part. I want to see the best of, you know, the few, and then bring them in and have them get the job. I mean, that's the whole thing. That's the goal. I need them to do well. Makes my job better.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Francesca Segre.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, online at kauffman.org, and by the FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
A License to Ill brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, moral hazard. A moral hazard is a concept insurers first dreamed up. It's a situation in which you're so protected financially that you feel free to act, well, badly. Like if you have a lot of car liability insurance, why not drive 100 miles per hour? If you crash, hey, you're covered. Some economists feel a big moral hazard could soon loom over the stock market. They fear the Fed will give in to nervous speculators and cut interest rates. That could make it even easier to speculate, leading to another kind of hazard, a market bubble.
Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Tess Vigeland, and with me is my good buddy and financial guru, Chris Farrell, who also happens to be our economics editor. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing just fine, thank you. You ready to take some calls?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, before we get to the questions, please do take down our website address. It's marketplace.org. Click on the contact button. Or if you like, you can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. All right, let's go to the phones. Rhonda is on the line from Wichita, Kansas. Hi, Rhonda.
Hello.
I understand you have something of a difficult question for us, but we're grateful to you for it because it's a very common one and a very, very good one. Tell us your situation right now.
Yeah, well, thank you. It is a difficult question to ask. My father is facing a terminal illness. Being the practical man that he is trying to cover all of the bases financially and in many other aspects to ensure that he leaves my mom and our family set up as best he can. And so my question for you is, what are the basics that we need to be thinking of, and are there anything that perhaps we've missed at this point?
Well, what have you done so far?
He has a living trust,
okay. And
they own their home, and that is in the trust. He also has living will, advance directives, powers of attorney for those types of things. And essentially, that's about it, as I understand it.
Chris, can you talk very briefly about the difference between a living trust and a living will? Rhonda said that her father has both.
Well, with the living will, it can be called different things, but this is essentially expressing your wishes as you enter into the medical system and you're facing very difficult choices. Are there certain treatments that you would not like, even if it might keep you alive because of the quality of life issues?
So it's not necessarily like a regular will where you set out what's going to go to whom?
No. Anybody who's facing a hospital situation, that's what you fill out, and you should.
And a living trust?
And a living trust is a form of ownership that allows you to avoid probate, which can be, you know, very complicated. And depending on your state, probate can be easy or it can be not so easy. So basically, it's a way of bringing your affairs into order. And where living trusts become especially important is if there's any property that is in, say, other states. It's very easy if you set up a trust.
Okay. Well, Chris, they're actually ahead of the game more than many other people are at this point. But what would be the next steps for them to think about as they face this situation?
One thing just for everybody out there who's facing the situation, in addition to a will, is to check your 401k plan, your IRA, your retirement plans, and make sure that you designated a beneficiary. Other things that I'd recommend, are there other children in the family?
Yes, actually, that's an interesting component. My sister is handicapped, and my dad is listed as her guardian, so we're also going through the process of changing her guardianship over to my mother and I.
Okay, good. The reason why I raised it is because when he passes away, you'll be taking a lot of responsibility, I imagine, as your mother gets older. And so you'd have a conversation about his wishes and what he would like. Then I dealt with this, my mother and sister did when my father passed away. And even though you have the living will and you have the advance directive, you know, you're going to have to make a time commitment to really be on top of the situation. And so part of it, I think, even though it sounds very soft, is, and it sounds like your father's extremely practical, so he's not going to have a problem having these conversations, is really understanding what it is that he wants, that even goes beyond what is in written down, and so that everybody is on the same page.
Rhonda, let me ask you, was this something that was difficult to bring up with your father at all? Because when this kind of situation comes up, often, you know, money is the last thing that you want to talk about, but it certainly is important. How did you broach it, or did he?
Well, actually, I think we've been given the gift of his practicality. And so we've talked about not specifics financially, but we've talked about what he wants done should he be unable to make healthcare decisions. We've talked about that well before he ever got sick.
Chris, how important is it for families to really decide to address what's really a nitty-gritty issue? It's a very emotional one as well.
I think that it is extremely important to have these conversations and get everything down. Another very practical thing is I imagine there's a lot of joint accounts. So you are probably spending a fair amount of your time and your mother will be spending a fair amount of her time getting the documents that need to be put into her name so she has access to the money. So the important role there is organization, making sure that you have all the documents of joint ownership so that you can get it into her name. Believe it or not, it's going to take a long period of time, a lot of calls, and that's where paperwork and documentation can become extremely important.
Is that something that we could do proactively? Is that something that we could be working on now?
Proactively, what you'd be doing is making sure that you know all the accounts and that you have all the documentation.
Okay.
And then when he passes away, then taking the death certificate and making sure that all the changes get made.
Okay.
All right. Any other questions, Rhonda? Does that help you out?
That helps me out tremendously. I thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you so much for the question that I'm sure a lot of people can relate to. And best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. All right, Chris. Well, from the profound to the somewhat more mundane, how about we reach into the email bag?
All right.
Denise writes in from Redwood City, California, and her college-age son is searching for apartments for the first time. So after many, many years, she is looking at rental applications. And, of course, we are now in the age of identity theft. And she says it's a little unnerving to be filling out all this confidential information, like social security numbers and bank account information. So her question is, what are owners, landlords, allowed to ask for and check up on? What kind of information should they be willing and prepared to divulge? What kind of information do they not have to do?
It's a really good question. There is no law that prevents a business from asking for your social security number. There's also no law that says you have to give it. However, they don't have to do business with you.
Right. They don't have to rent to you if you don't give it to them.
Exactly. It's a little bit of catch-22. Now, first of all, what I would do is say, you know, do I have to give you my social security number? I'm giving the bank account information. I'm giving my driver's license. Isn't that enough? And in today's world, sometimes that may work. Sometimes it may be that you're just going to have to move on and decide, well, I'm not going to rent from this person. Or you may have to say, all right, I really do want to be in this apartment. The landlord is insisting on the social security number. I'm going to cross my fingers and do it. But it does not hurt to ask and say, look, in today's world, I don't want to give out my social security number. Can I just avoid giving you my social security number? You can check out my other information.
All right. Well, we don't ask for your social security number or your credit score or even your last name. All we need is your personal finance question. Click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org or call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And again, we spell that M-O-N-Y. All right. Let's hit the phones again. Cynthia's on the line from Wellington, Colorado. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi.
So what's your question for Chris today?
Well, I have two mortgages on my home, and the first one is held by American Home Mortgage.
Uh-oh.
I have been trying not to panic over the news, but I'm really not sure what to expect. Will, now that they've declared bankruptcy and they're, I read on the internet that they were going to put the company up for sale next month, what's going to happen to that first mortgage? Will it get sold? And if it does get sold, will the terms stay the same? Or am I going to have to start all over again and try to find a new first mortgage?
What kind of loan do you have currently?
When I got this loan, I was planning on selling my house. Actually, I had tried to sell my house in 2003, 2004, and was unable to do it. So I refinanced, and I got a fixed rate, five-year interest-only loan, thinking that in 5 years, hopefully the market will turn around and I'll be able to sell my house.
So that would be in what, 2009?
2009. November of 2009 is when it's going to adjust.
All right. Well, Chris, this is something that's going to come up more and more as these mortgage companies are going under. This is not good news for the folks whose mortgages they're holding. So what happens to the mortgage when your mortgage company goes under?
For someone who is hoping to take out a mortgage, yeah, it's kind of a bad situation. But for someone who has a mortgage with American Home, no implications whatsoever. It doesn't affect the status of your mortgage loan at all. It's already on the books. What will probably happen, and I think you're absolutely right, another financial institution is going to come in and they'll buy the company's loans. There is no change. All that's changing is the financial institution that holds the mortgage. The one recommendation that I would make and very strongly make is several years ago, there was a flurry of studies looking into adjustable rate mortgages and what you have is a five-year adjustable rate mortgage. And as these mortgages go from one financial institution to another for a variety of reasons, there can be mistakes made in terms of what they adjust the mortgage to. So just keep really good paper records along the way in case that happens to you. But as far as you having to worry about American Home because it's in bankruptcy and likely to be sold, it's no problem. Somebody else will pick up your loan and you do not have to renegotiate it.
Okay.
Or does that help you out?
That's a big relief.
Good.
That's what I was hoping the answer would be.
Terrific. Well, best of luck to you.
All right. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, no need to panic. There is always hope when it comes to your financial horizon, and we're here to help you find it. Do give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or visit our website. We're at marketplace.org and click on the contact button. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, Chris, one more reach into the email bag. Alex has written in from Pasadena, Ohio, not Pasadena, California, which is where I live.
Ah.
Anyway, Alex recently quit his job, and understandably, he won't be receiving any company benefits because he said bye-bye. He's concerned mostly, though, about his life insurance. And according to his agent, he has a couple of choices. One, continue the coverage from this former employer at what he calls an amazingly high monthly payment. Or to start a new term life policy. If he does that, he'll have to undergo a medical exam, but that could potentially reduce the monthly payment by more than half. But here's the kicker. Alex has a pre-existing health condition. What do you think of these first two options, and are there any others?
Well, my reaction to this is you have an insurance agent. And this is a classic case where an insurance agent can really help you and run some numbers, all right? So you know what the price is going to be if you continue the insurance policy from your employer. We don't know what the pre-existing condition is, but make some phone calls and find out what would it really cost me. If you want to do some research on your own, there's some calculators like efinancial.com.
And we'll have a link to that on our website.
We'll have a link to that. And there's a number of other calculators that are out there, and you can try and do a little bit of your own shopping around.
Are there any options beyond either just sticking with his former employer or starting a new term life policy?
I mean, those seem like the two main options. Now, of course, I would have to ask a really basic question. Okay, do you really need life insurance? Now, why do you need life insurance? I'm a fundamentalist when it comes to life insurance. The reason why you need life insurance is to protect someone you love. If there's no one, if you don't have children, if you don't have a partner, if you don't have a spouse, you could probably pass on it for now.
All right. Well, unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take for this week's program. But please do call in with your questions for a future program. Our voicemail is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. That's M-O-N-Y. Or visit our website, we're at marketplace.org, and click on the contact button. Chris, as always, thanks so much for your wise counsel.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
Coming up, a visit with our Virginia Investment Club. They decide which stocks they're just not that into.
This is one, yeah. I would still watch. Some of the other ones, it's like, as I said, it's like breaking up with a boyfriend. You're just not going back there. But,
And we have a report card on the best 529 college plans. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Back now to our investment club series. We're following three clubs, one in Seattle, another in San Jose, and a third in Fairfax, Virginia, as they figure out what stocks to buy, sell, and hold throughout the year.
The stock didn't do very well.
What sectors do you buy?
Prices are going to continue to go up.
Join the club.
We're back with formerly Baroque, 12 Virginia women who gather once a month on Saturday mornings to talk stocks, bonds, limit orders, and grandkids. On this visit in late July, club member Carol Sheehan arrived bleary-eyed from a night spent with a certain boy wizard whose final exploits had arrived at bookstores just hours before.
I thought, well, I'm going to just try to really read through. No food breaks.
Oh, Harry Potter?
You even took a nap.
I even took a nap.
That's
yesterday day.
I'm on now page 156.
You were up all night reading
the
book?
Yeah, I stayed up till 4.
Are there any corrections to last month's minutes?
Once they got down to business, the talk turned to another pop culture phenomenon, the iPhone, which launched just days after their last meeting in June.
Apple, Rose, $143.75.
Okay, when I talked about it last month, it was $120.50 a share.
Do you remember why you decided not to buy it?
Well, we didn't really, we weren't talking in terms of buy. It was something to continue to look back at. We didn't have any money, the decisions we had already made.
And that's high for us.
And that was
anything
high.
Over $100, that's an expensive stock for us. We don't like to spend that kind of
But money. We have recently.
Yeah, we.
But that's the other challenge, when to sell, but also when to buy, because when we look at this curve, we say, well, we've missed it.
Turns out they wouldn't have missed it. They would have ridden Apple stock up about $25 a share. But enough with regrets, because as of July, and bear in mind this was just prior to the recent market meltdown, these women were reveling in $118,000 worth of stock investments, a $20,000 gain since April. How'd they do it? Follow the numbers for their first stock, the investment management firm Franklin Resources.
Okay, I think we'll go on to reviewing our positions. And Pat, if we could start with you.
Not too much on them, other than the fact that they went down $4.26 yesterday. But more importantly, they've gone up 66.5% in this year. And the S&P has only gone up 19.5%.
The club posted a 5% gain since buying the stock. It's also up 31% on a farm machinery company called CNH Global and a whopping 86% on its initial investment in Sun Hydraulics. Since our last visit, they've also ventured into a type of fund known as an ETF. Theirs is in Brazil.
Yeah, we decided we'd try an exchange-traded fund, and Brazil has done very well for us. We own 100 shares. We're up $951, or 16% in, what, 2 months?
2 months,
yeah. The international economies are doing really great.
How did you guys decide on Brazil?
It was the best one. And then I did research on the Brazilian economy, and it was phenomenal.
And so this is something new for you? You haven't done an ETF
before? We never
did
an ETF, no.
Okay. From something new to something old, relatively speaking, Crocs has been the story of this club throughout the year. Alas, it may get tossed in the old shoe bin. But not before club member Maureen Anderson shares news of the latest Crocs fashionistas.
I don't know. You all saw the article in the paper where, in the style section, first page, President Bush had them on.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And then socks. The price went down.
He had them on with socks.
That's really dorky.
I know. And then there was a comment about that.
But on the Crocs website, it says wear them with socks or without. This was, I forget where I got this, but you can see the headline, Mahara Hara. Crocs, the season's ugliest shoes are taking over Hollywood. Jack Nicholson wears Crocs, and Rosie O'Donnell. That didn't impress me too much. The big thing is we had it split last month, so we had 800 shares. We sold 400. It was very volatile. For me, I think what we're betting on is what are the earnings going to be. And maybe after earnings would be the time to sell it.
Now, you're going to sell Crocs?
Well, that's the problem.
See, that's
fall in love with these stocks. And being women, I think we get emotionally attached. I don't know.
How have you done on it overall since you invested in it?
For the 400 that we sold, we made over $6,700 on that.
$6,816, and then we're about $7,500 on what we own now.
So that's in percentage, do you know?
No, in percentage, it's
74% gain.
Well, that's the ones we sold. The one we sold, we.
But overall, since you started investing in it, you've had
more than
gains of 70-80%.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
It's a home run.
Indeed, they did sell another 300 shares of Crocs to make room for a couple of new investments. The first proposed by Janelle Usselman.
Diana Shipping Inc. And this is in the transportation shipping industry. It's right now at $28.51. It deals mostly with ore, coal, grain, and other dry cargoes along world shipping routes. If they stay on track for their earnings, they'll have 40% increase in net income over last year.
They decided to buy 200 shares of Diana Shipping, plus 100 shares of Jacobs Engineering, and 100 more shares of the Brazil ETF.
Any other business? Okay. And I think we're adjourned.
Thank you.
After our visit, I checked in to find out how the recent market swings affected the club's portfolio. They'd lost about 12% off the bottom line as of August 17th and pulled a good chunk of their money out of the markets. Next week, it's back to the Emerald City to see how our Seattle club is holding up amid the mortgage mess. And one more development out of our meeting with the ladies of formerly Baroque. They've got fans. A brand new club is starting in Virginia, thanks to Marketplace Money listener Dorothy Ogilvie-Lee.
I had the radio on, and a few of the words really caught my ear, like investment and women's and club. And I have been wanting to get involved in something like this for years, but just really didn't know how to pursue it, or, you know, wasn't that motivated to just really go after it.
After some tutoring from formerly Baroque members Dee Cardiff and Janelle Usselman, Ogilvie-Lee asked friends and neighbors to join, and they asked friends and neighbors. There are now 10 of them, and they're still learning the ropes.
Even in the very first meeting, each one of us as new members picked a stock out of a hat, literally. And these were our training stocks. So what we were doing is we had to come home, pretend that we purchased 100 shares of it. We watched it for the month. Then we make, when we go back to the second meeting, making a decision is whether we think we should hold or sell the stock and present our findings to the rest of the people.
And for all of our other listeners who wonder whether this kind of commitment is really doable?
It's very doable, and it's a lot more fun than I thought it would be. There's so much available, particularly on the web, of, you know, instruction and things on terms, and I just think it's a good hobby, for one thing. It's not a huge investment. This is workable.
That's Dorothy Ogilvie-Lee, founder of the new Virginia Investment Club called, well, they're still searching for a catchy name.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
High school seniors will soon be making their list and checking it twice of places to apply to college. Hopefully, they and their folks started planning the finances of that education early on, like opening up a 529 college savings account. Penelope Wang is a senior writer at Money Magazine, and the latest issue rates plans from different states. So, Penny, what is the first thing that parents should do?
The very first thing they should do is check to see what's available in their own state. See if you like the plan there in terms of the investment choices that it offers, as well as the expenses on that plan.
And for those who are new to the idea of a 529 plan, the reason we're saying this is because you can actually get one from a state that you don't live in.
That's right. Most plans are available both to residents and people who live out of state. So if you don't have a tax break on your own state plan or you're not happy with it, it's very easy to look around and invest in one that's offered elsewhere.
Once you've decided which state you're going to go with in terms of which might be the best for tax purposes, what's the next thing you should be looking at?
The next thing you should be looking at is the expenses on the plan. A number of plans are still too expensive to justify investing, particularly with many advisor sole plans. But fortunately, costs are coming down on a lot of the direct sole plans, and that's probably the first place you should look. After that, you should look at the investment manager and see if it's one that you feel comfortable with.
Can you explain to us the difference between advisor sold and direct sold plans?
Sure. Advisor sold, as it suggests, is plans that are sold through investment advisors, brokers. In a sense, you're paying additional costs for the investment advice, which is fine if you need that investment advice, but you need to weigh the costs against what sort of returns you're ultimately going to get.
Now, once you've decided which state you're going to pick, this is very similar to the question that you would have in a retirement fund, but how do you decide which funds to pick within your plan?
Well, as you say, it is very similar to choosing investments in a retirement plan, because a lot of these plans offer what are called age-based funds, which are similar to what's increasingly popular in retirement plans, target date funds, where you pick an investment based on the date that you think you're going to cash it out, and the asset allocation gradually moves as you get closer to that date. So if your child, say, is going to reach college in 5 years, you'd pick an age-based plan that matures in 5 years, and you just keep up your contributions and you don't have to do much else. The investments gradually become more conservative, more fixed income and cash, so there's less risk of a market drop hurting your investment just as you're planning to cash it out. With 529s, you can't tweak your investments that frequently as you can in, say, a 401k. You can only alter your investments once a year, so you don't really have that many options in terms of changing the allocation on your own anyway.
Well, so that would then imply that you should be checking in on it at least once a year?
Absolutely. You need to keep track of it. It's not a set it and forget it. You have to make sure the investments are on track to where you want to go. And if for some reason you do want to change, you do have that option. You can change plans once a year. You can change your investments once a year. So you do have some exit strategies if you're not happy with your plan. But beyond that, the main thing is to keep up your contributions, which is always the hardest part.
Penny Wang is a senior writer for Money Magazine. Thanks so much for the advice.
Thank you.
And you'll find a link to Penny's article at marketplace.org. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
it's like it's going to be the best quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor, Chris Farrell, to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what's the straight story. And Chris, you know, right now, Wall Street traders are grabbing that last bit of vacation on the beach in the Hamptons or perhaps in the south of France. But, you know, with all the turmoil in the markets, I'd imagine that they're pretty glued to their BlackBerries. They're not enjoying the sunsets these days.
I think the same thing. I mean, they've got to be wondering when, not if, the next bout of trouble will erupt. Will it be in Europe?
Yeah.
How about Asia? Will a big Wall Street hedge fund go belly up? Another mortgage lender?
Another one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you mentioned mortgages, a big trouble spot in the economy right now, and I've got a question here. This week, the mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac offered to help everybody out by increasing their holdings of mortgages. And in fact, Senator Chuck Schumer said he's going to introduce some legislation to that effect, but regulators have said no way. Good move on their part?
Well, I'm in the camp that says yes, because the reputations of Fannie and Freddie have been tarnished by these accounting and management scandals, and they're still fixing the problems. So here's the straight story. Martin Fritzen is a longtime player in the credit markets, got it right when he called this a harebrained scheme.
Hmm.
I couldn't say it better.
All right. Well, for our listeners who may not exactly know, what are Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? What do they do?
Well, these were companies that were chartered to supply cash to the mortgage market. They now own or hold in their portfolio 40% of the nearly $11 trillion residential mortgage market. So they're the key players in the mortgage market, providing a lot of liquidity, a lot of buying and selling. They guarantee a lot of the mortgage-backed securities. So they're big.
So essentially, they buy up the mortgages from other lenders.
That's right. And so what Fannie Mae, for example, offered to do was say, look, our portfolio at the moment is capped at, it's around $722 billion, Tess.
Mm-hmm.
And it's capped there because the regulators have said, look, until you get this accounting and management scandal all fixed up, we're not going to let you increase your size.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, well, let us increase it by 10% to, if I do my math right, $800 billion.
Okay.
Because a lot of banks are complaining that, you know, they're issuing mortgages, but then they can't sell them, which is what banks always want to do. They want to get them on the books.
Right.
So what, you know, it's a reasonable argument. I mean, Fannie's saying, look, we'll provide some more liquidity and that'll calm down. Banks will be more willing to write some mortgages. So on the surface, seemed like a reasonable suggestion.
In terms of how this actually works for an individual, what Fannie and Freddie were proposing to do was to raise the cap on the size of the mortgage that they could back, right? Right now it's $417,000, and that's what's called a conforming loan. And if you had a mortgage that was above that, called a jumbo loan, it's not backed by Fannie and Freddie. So they were proposing that rise from the $417,000.
Right. And the jumbo market is a market where there are some problems. You know, it's almost like a barbell. You have a lot of problems that we talked about in the subprime market.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the jumbo market, which really affects places like where you live, Los Angeles, right. New York, San Francisco, Miami, where
property is incredibly expensive.
Yeah, places where $417,000 doesn't get you much. So there has been a tightening in that market, too.
All right. So look, a lot of homeowners are losing their homes at this point. Why not go ahead and make this move to help stabilize the market?
Because I think there are some real issues about their accounting and their management structure and legitimate debates about whether or not both Fannie and Freddie have become too big. And that's been a debate that's been going on. And I think what they're trying to do under the guise of a crisis is short-circuit that whole argument.
Hmm.
Secondly, I really feel terrible for people who are losing their homes. That doesn't mean there isn't action. And you've talked about several of the programs that are out there, tests and previous shows. You know, a lot of states and nonprofits and even some of the banks are getting together and realizing, you know, foreclosure is not necessarily the best thing for everybody.
Right.
And let's see what we can work out. There are going to be some people who should never have bought. They're going to go into foreclosure. But there are other people who maybe work it out. So just the fact that Freddie and Fannie can't come into this market or expand their presence in the market is really what I'm saying,
right,
is not the same thing as saying, well, we're just going to abandon all these people who are either facing foreclosure or extremely nervous that may be their future.
All right. The straight story from our man, Chris Farrell. Chris, thanks for never abandoning us.
Tess, I would never do that to you.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, our Seattle Investment Club gets intimate with the price-to-earnings ratio.
I would say if you're going to invest, get to know your PE, get to understand what happens to PE. It can be a very healthy relationship, or it can sometimes be up and down, as you say.
Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali with Rico Galliano, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Phillippe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Orr. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.